Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thank you for listening. This is A Cult of Personality podcast, episode number 122, featuring an interview with scholar and author Richard Kaczynski. You can find us online at acultofpersonality.net, which features a large assortment of recorded interviews for your listening pleasure. Support for A Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as all those generous listeners from all over the world who click the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website to sponsor this episode. Thanks again to Steve M., Lance in Massachusetts, Steve S., Skip, Shadowlit Productions, and Tau DeCetheus, whose website can be found at lightofthenosis.org. Because of these donations, as well as the subscribers to the membership section, A Cult of Personality podcast is able to remain completely independent. I'm proud of that fact and grateful for your support to be able to maintain it. Just a reminder that the 2012 Esoteric Book Conference will take place in Seattle, Washington on September 15th and 16th. Tickets are available through their website at esotericbookconference.com, and I look forward to seeing you there. Now, in podcast episode number 122, an interview with scholar and author Richard Kaczynski. You can find Richard online at richard-kaczynski.com, and that's spelled K-A-C-Z-Y-N-S-K-I. His book, Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, is by my estimation, and many others, the definitive biography of the great beast 666, which is the focus of this interview. In 2010, the book was re-released as an expanded and revised edition by North Atlantic Books, and I cannot praise it too highly. It is an authoritative and scholarly exposition on the life and work of Aleister Crowley, arguably one of the most important historical figures in the Western esoteric tradition. The book has received tremendous accolades from readers, both inside and outside of the esoteric realms. Because of his excellent work on the Perdurabo book, I would also highly recommend his recently published early history of the Ordo Templi Orientis, entitled The Forgotten Templars. Please see the links in the show notes for information about acquiring Richard Kaczynski's wonderful books if you don't already possess them. Richard Kaczynski, I want to welcome you to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's wonderful to speak with you, 93.
Yeah, 93, and it's wonderful to have the opportunity to speak to you as well. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. The main reason I wanted to speak with you is based on your book, Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley, which was, I believe, recently republished. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, it was issued in a revised and expanded edition released by North Atlantic Books in August of 2010.
Excellent.
Yeah, so there's lots of photos. There are no photos in the first edition, and there's probably about 150 pages of new content as well. So it's very much a new sort of book, and even a lot of the content that, you know, remains has been kind of edited and revised, fact-checked, and so on. So, yeah, it's definitely worth the upgrade if you've read the original but not the new version. It's worth switching.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm, along with many, many other people, very impressed with the book. It's really a fine biography,
well written, obviously well researched, notated like crazy. And as far as I'm concerned, and I think I'm not alone here, this is the definitive biography of Aleister Crowley.
Well, thank you. It's safe to say that this new expanded edition really is everything I wanted the book to be. So I wasn't required to cut things out or cut any corners at all. So I'm very happy with the way it turned out.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of people are, for sure. So before we go any further in talking about the book or Aleister Crowley himself, I'd like to spend just a few minutes, if we could, getting a little bit more acquainted with you. And if you wouldn't mind just telling us a little bit about your esoteric and academic background, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, I mean, as far as my academic background goes, I guess I'll deal with that first. That's easiest to deal with. I have bachelor's, master's, and PhD degrees in psychology. My specialization was in social psychology and research methodology and design. And my dissertation looked at the structure and correlates of metaphysical beliefs. Essentially, you know, what kinds of things did people believe and what personality traits may go along with those. And while my professional career has, you know, kind of partly gone off into another direction, which is mostly statistical sort of biomedical research, I still maintain an interest in the, you know, the esoteric and new religious movements and things like that that was covered by my dissertation. And I do try and, you know, keep active in that field and, you know, write and publish academically when the opportunity presents itself.
Mm-hmm.
As far as my personal esoteric interests, that started, I mean, it's almost always been a part of my life. I don't know if it's a function of the time I grew up in or what, but like the other day I had gotten the new edition of Stephen Skinner's book on geomancy. And this is really kind of an exciting thing for me because one of the earliest esoteric books I had, or actually two of the earliest esoteric books I had, one was, you know, Francis King's Techniques of High Magic, and the other one was Stephen King's The Oracle of Geomancy. And I was just marveling at the idea that I had both of these as just, you know, regular paperbacks that I made my mom buy me from the local grocery store. And it's just, and just thinking back and just saying, these books are a grocery store.
Wow.
Like, how weird is that? And it just seems like, again, it was just my whole life was like that. You know, the library I grew up with had, you know, a lot of occult books, a lot of, like, you know, James G. Frazier and, you know, Leggy, you know, the Forerunners and Rivals of Christianity, had Plato in Greek, and this is kind of like the stuff I go to the library and get out. And, you know, between that and, you know, the In Search of TV program, you know, with Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, yeah.
And, all those, you know, and, those weird documentary movies that used to come out about, you know, In Search of Noah's Ark and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was everywhere when I grew up. So, my sister had done research on witchcraft. She had interviewed a famous Detroit area witch by the name of Gundella as part of her, you know, junior high independent research project. And once she had kind of lost interest and moved on with that, I remained fascinated by this drawer with incense and tarot cards and planchettes that she had, you know. And yeah, so eventually I kind of, you know, stumbled into actually starting to read and study this kind of seriously around the age of 14. And the proprietor of a local metaphysical bookshop that I went to, Paul Hudson's Mayflower Bookshop, I don't know, he saw something in me, you know, and kind of pointed me to, you know, Magic and Theory and Practice, you know, and said, here, you want to read this? I think I picked up, like, Rarity's Golden Dawn book and said, oh, if you like that, you'll like this.
Mm.
You know, and he kind of steered me to some other books and, you know, haven't looked back.
Excellent. So from reading Magic and Theory and Practice, that kind of drew you in, and your interest in Kalima and Crowley kind of blossomed from there, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, you know, it was the black, you know, Dover paperback that so many people have. And You know, what it was, I was reading the introduction, and I got to the end of that, you know, where Crowley signs the introduction, and he gives all of his magical mottos. And so you see they're given by, you know, Aleister Crowley, Perdurabo, you know, zero equals zero, blah, blah, blah. And I just read this, and again, not really doing anything about Crowley. I got to that, and I said, this means something. I don't know what this means, but I know it means something. I'm going to figure it out. And, you know, so I kind of became determined, and you know, that's really one of the challenges of management theory and practice. But Crowley's works in general is that he tends to be very self-referential. So in magic, he refers to all kinds of other, you know, libers and texts of his that have been published elsewhere. And you know, at the time the management theory and practice came out in 1929, 1930, a lot of that stuff hadn't even been published yet. You know, it circulated amongst the students, you know, so you kind of have to read a lot of Crowley and then kind of go back, you know, a second time before you start to get what he's talking about, because he's just kind of all over the place and presuming a lot of familiarity with his works. At least his technical writings are. I mean, he can write very, he's capable of writing very lucid things as well. And I had co-edited a collection of those papers called The Revival of Magic. And I think the beauty of that collection is that, you know, he's writing for a lay audience, not a technical audience, and those papers have none of the problems that I just mentioned, you know, encountering as a first-time reader of Vatican theory and practice.
It's very interesting. Yeah, I would agree. His writing is certainly requires a lot more study and inside knowledge than most other occult teachers and writers. His documentation system is unique, I think, in that respect, and really stands alone amongst any kind of school in that respect.
I can remember. You know, I was about 14 when I got Magic Imperium practice, and again, I eventually worked my way up to Equinox. You know, so I can remember reading through that maybe even like a year later. And at some point, kind of going, oh, now I get what he was talking about back in magic theory practice. You know, just the light bulbs starting to go on. You know. And anyway, you look at, you know, the probation or the student reading list, you know, for the AA, and you get that he's presuming quite a lot of familiarity, not only with, you know, occultism, but just with, you know, philosophers of science and just regular philosophers, Asian, you know, mysticism and so on, before we even begin getting into the stuff he's talking about.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to be inspired to write the biography.
Basically what happened was, you know, I had read a biography of Crowley that had come out sometime in the late 80s. And, you know, at that point, you know, I had been studying Crowley's works pretty, you know, seriously for, you know, 15 years at that point. And I had read several of the other biographies out there. And this particular one I read and I thought, wow, this really sucks. I thought, I could do better than that. And there was just a little voice in my head that said, well, why don't you? And that, you know, the rest is history. I probably listened to the voice in my head. You know, not always the best, you know, advice, but I did on this occasion, and it seemed to work out okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it took, you know, many years. I mean, I can't say that I spent, you know, all of, you know, 15 or 20 years every day working on the book, but you know, it was a process of 15 years of research, writing, revision, updating, mailing out the manuscript, and so on before the book finally was published. So, you know, then a long road. And then when I did the new edition, you know, I've been collecting new information ever since the book came out. And then I also undertook a whole bunch of, you know, brand new research for this edition. So it's, you know, in many ways, it's kind of really the product of, you know, 2 decades of work. So, you know, very happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's safe to say it's a labor of love, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not doing it for the money.
The thing that really strikes me about the book, well, there are many. I mean, But the fact that the research is so meticulous and your footnotes, it's really, I have to say, having read a lot of historical academic journals and books recently, it's really written in an academic style with the same attention to detail and concern for sources and all of that, which I just wonder if you could take just a minute and talk about your desire to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think in one way it reflects, you know, my academic day job, which is, you know, writing research papers, and, you know, there's a lot of scientific rigor and the requirement for citation, you know, that, you know, goes with that, and that probably bled into, you know, the book itself. And I think part of it is just, you know, it's a sort of attention to detail that comes with any kind of, I'm not sure what the best word would be, geekdom or fandom or whatever, you know, but, you know, people who are into Star Trek really are, you know, obsessed with all the little details of Stardates and things like that. And, you know, I don't want mean to put, you know, people who are really into Crowley kind of into the same category as Trekkies, but I think it's a similar sort of passion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly have an attention to detail about Crowley, and I know from talking to Thelemites all over the world that many of them do as well, and they share that passion of mine. And in fact, I can remember that there's a couple of instances with the first edition of Pergarabo where people have asked me things like, oh, you know, where did you find a citation for this or that? And there have been like quite one or two instances where, because there have been so many different revisions or little things kind of added in over the years, that I couldn't quite track down in my notes where a particular thing came from. And then I felt really bad because, like, you know, obviously it came from somewhere, but, you know, I couldn't find it in my file cabinets. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure everything that I added in this new edition getting very meticulously documented, not only for my own reference, but for other people who want to be able to go back and double check and confirm these things. And, you know, again, you know, who knows, you know, what some of this information could lead to for other researchers down the line.
For me personally, I've already discovered things in the book that I hadn't ever found elsewhere that were really highly personally significant to me, and several times my jaw was just left hanging open. Again, I don't think I'm alone in that type of experience.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I think one of the most challenging things I found in writing this was that every time I introduced a person, I thought it was important that it not just be a name. You know, they came into Crowley's life for a reason. Crowley was interested in them, you know, as a student, as a lover, or as a business associate, or whatever, for some reason. And if you just drop a name, you know, it doesn't mean anything. You know, it might have meant something 50 years ago, or, you know, or 100 years ago when these people were alive, but a lot of these people were names that I didn't really know a lot about. And when I started digging into their background and, you know, checking over just if you know, just to verify their birth and death dates, but, you know, you find out some more information about them, and it's like everyone has an interesting story. And so the challenge was, well, I want to bring these people to life. I don't want them to be names, but at the same time, it's like it's not their story. It's Crowley's story, you know, and
mm-hmm.
how much to put in and how much to leave out, you know, but it's just... It was just fascinating digging all that stuff up, and there's all these little things, you know, not only about the people at Crowley know you, but about Crowley's own life that normally didn't get talked about. Are just endlessly fascinating to me.
Oh, no doubt, which we should get into more in detail. So in speaking about Aleister Crowley, the Great Beast, 666, I guess we might as well start in a chronological way. That would probably be the best. His early life, his family background. He came from a highly religious, I might even say like fundamentalist type of background.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the two biggest factors in Crowley's childhood and his upbringing are his, you know, his family's faith and family fortune. So it's clearly had a really big effect on the rest of his life, I think. And, you know, his family, you know, his family came from a long line of Quaker stock, you know, but his father had converted to the Plymouth Reverent faith, which is, a fundamentalist faith. It is, you know, millennial in the sense that they're expecting, you know, Christ to come back literally at any moment. And that, you know, things like planning for the future, you know, seems to show a lack of, you know, faith that Christ is imminently returning. And they, you know, again, they believe in the literal truth of the Bible, and everything written in it is fact, that, you know, the universe was created in 4004 BC and all the rest that goes with it. And because of that, you know, he had a very strict upbringing. You know, only other members of the church or of the faith were allowed to teach him, or other teachers who were, you know, vetted as being suitable, and even his, you know, outside of school reading material was prescribed. You know, they didn't really celebrate Christmas because that was a pagan holiday. I guess they're kind of right on that one. But, you know, it was, you know, pervasive. Crowley writes about how, you know, his reading material as a child was the Bible, and, you know, for dinner they did Bible readings and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And his father was a lay preacher in the faith as well, so they weren't just, you know, churchgoers, but his father was actually, you know, he would travel around the countryside preaching, handing out tracts to people, and so on. And, you know, that's, I see a lot of that in Crowley, you know, again, who traveled around the world and kind of talked about Thelema to anyone who was willing to listen and give him half an ear.
Right, right. It was fascinating, his, these patterns that sort of play themselves out. And I'm sure that anybody listening who's had a similar upbringing can really identify with that early indoctrination or inculcation of the symbolism, the stories, and all of the feelings that really come with them.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, I think it's important to bear in mind that Crowley doesn't really talk about his upbringing as being bad. And he actually, you know, idolized his father and looked up to him quite a lot. And when he died, it was a really great loss to him. You know, and it's not until other people stepped in and tried to fill his father's shoes that he began to look at their faith and kind of react kind of violently against it, you know. And I guess not violently, but he just, you know, he didn't, no one could step into his father's shoes, and he resisted anyone attempting to do that, whether it was his Uncle Tom or his mother or anyone else. But, you know, he had, it's not like he suffered at the hands of his mom and dad over a faith. It was more, you know, there's these incidents that happened at school, you know, that are pretty well known in Crowley's story. And, but, you know, given, you know, his background, it's not surprising that, you know, when you see things like, you know, his Enochian visions, that, you know, the imagery and the language of them is extremely biblical, and that he identified with, you know, the beast in the book of Revelation and so on. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a byproduct of, you know, the religion in which he was steeped.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think that seems pretty clear that it had a very strong influence on him. In fact, I'm curious about your opinion on some of the activities that he excelled at as a young man, mountaineering and poetry, which to me have this element of sort of reaching for the divine, just as in a religious sense where you're climbing a mountain, where you're trying to sort of aspire to some sublime state through the use of verse.
That's interesting. I guess I couldn't disagree with that. I don't know if I've thought about it quite in those terms, but I could certainly see your point. You know, the mountains of the, you know, of many cultures are considered to be, you know, the home of the gods, and they are sacred places. In fact, you know, one of the reasons that Crowley never attempted Mount Everest in his lifetime was that Europeans simply weren't allowed there. Because it was considered to be sacred ground. You know, and you'd even bet that if Crowley could have gotten out of Mount Everest, he would have climbed it, you know, but he had to settle for, you know, the second highest mountain in the world, which by most people's account is actually the most difficult to climb. But so there is that, and the poetry certainly has those aspects of the divine and the ecstatic, and it's, you know, particularly true in Crowley's poetry, because you see all kinds of references to both the ecstatic and the divine, particularly, you know, in all its forms. You know, I mean, the divine, you know, of all sorts of different creeds and, you know, nations get invoked in his works.
Mm.
But I guess I also kind of think of these things as almost reactions to his upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the poetry in a sense was that, you know, he wasn't really allowed to read a lot of literature that wasn't the Bible. And once he had a chance to read, you know, Byron and Swinburne and so on, he just loved this.
Right.
And it was almost like an act of rebellion in a way to, you know, not only read this stuff, but to write stuff like it, you know. And, you know, small wonder that, you know, one of the first, you know, or among his first works that he wrote, you know, was this, you know, decadent collection of poems, you know, White Stains. You know, again, it wasn't his first work. That was a very early one for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of shows the influence of, you know, not only the poets that he was reading, but just the whole, you know, the decadent movement that was sweeping through France at that time. And I guess similarly with the mountain climbing, I mean, it's not like there was a religious prohibition in mountain climbing, but the reason he got into climbing was that he was, you know, mistreated at school by his schoolmasters, and as a result came down with albuminuria. And it's actually, this is the same thing that his uncle died of, like within a year after his father died. It's like the two male role models of his life, you know, died, you know, bam, bam. And when Crowley came down with this disease that his uncle died from, you can imagine the family was freaked out by this, and the doctors did think he was going to live. And he was sent out for rest cures, and as he went out and exercised and bicycled and took up climbing, kind of for his own, the sake of his own health, he not only did he recover, but he found that he really liked climbing. And that led to him, you know, climbing all over the world. I mean, he climbed not only in England, but in Switzerland and Germany, but also in Mexico and, you know, in the Himalayas and so on. And a lot of those places he held, you know, set records that stood for many, many decades.
Yeah, it seems like he was recognized almost after the fact as a great climber.
Yeah, and that's actually been fairly recent. Most of the time, he's been dismissed by climbers because he's, you know, people thought he was kind of reckless. You know, that, you know, he didn't really play by the rules. You know, a lot of the climbing that was going on was kind of overseen by the Alpine Club, or people were members of the Alpine Club, and Crowley didn't like authority, and therefore he didn't really like the Alpine Club. And his teacher, Oscar Eckenstein, didn't particularly like the Alpine Club either. So, you know, they were kind of renegades, and they didn't really get, you know, their kind of respect. And of course, then there was the incident, you know, in his climb where two of his team members died in an avalanche, and just kind of the dispute between Crowley and, you know, Guillaumard over what happened, you know, just kind of, you know, gave, you know, tainted Crowley's name in a lot of historians' minds. And it's only now that people look back and they realize, you know, he was, you know, today, you know, you have all sorts of these, you know, sort of really out there sorts of, you know, rock star, you know, athletes, and Crowley would fit right in with, you know, that kind of ethos today. But they realized that, you know, Crowley's climbs were not only very, very difficult, but the fact that he was able to do some of the stuff without any of the aids that people have nowadays, whether it be oxygen or the sorts of climbing tools that are routine. I mean, this was, you know, very primitive, rugged climbing, and he did stuff that, you know, is still difficult today, you know, with all the extra tools that people have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought the way that you really went into the incident on, what is it, Kanchenjunga? I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Kanchenjunga.
Kanchenjunga, okay.
Well, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly either, but be that as it may.
In many other sources, Crowley is made out to be far more negligent. And when I read the details of the story and like what actually occurred, and it casts things in a different light, I think. I'm just curious what your opinion is on the whole thing.
Well, it's interesting actually that you should say that you found the take to be less severe, because, you know, again, I did want to try to give both sides of the story, and I think the kind of unflattering side of the story is extremely unflattering, but at the same time, I mean, you know, this stuff that Corey talks about is, you know, these people were essentially abandoning the climb. You know, Crowley was the team leader, and they were not listening to him. He said, "Don't climb now. It's nighttime, you know, or it's late in the day. It's going to be nighttime before you get down, and it's going to be dangerous." You know, those are things that, you know, a climber, you know, would tell you are true. You know, but at the same time, you know, for Crowley to say, "Oh, I heard cries of help. Well, let me know if you need anything. Otherwise, I'm going to sit here and sip some tea and go to sleep." You know, it's not exactly the sort of thing that gives you warm fuzzies either. But I do really very much need to give a shout out to the librarian with the Alpine Club. They had a file of a lot of articles that, again, people hadn't really referred back to get the details of the story. And they very, very kindly, made photocopies of this stuff in their notebooks and sent them to me. So I was able actually to quote, you know, what both sides were arguing and the threats as it happened. And that really helped me to flesh out, you know, what everyone thought was really going on. And, you know, I don't know, it's, everyone can draw their own conclusion. I think that's ultimately where I leave the whole book. You know, I kind of want to present the facts. I don't want to assume a position either pro or against Crowley. I just want to say, here's the facts, here's what happened, here's what, you know, Crowley said, here's what Peter Falk said. You make up your mind.
Part of the reason I bring this up, and we maybe can address it now and instead of later on, is throughout Crowley's life, there are many instances when people close to him or involved with him face really unfortunate ends. Sometimes they die, sometimes they just have other problems. But it seems to be like almost a repeating pattern. And maybe I'm just viewing it that way incorrectly, because I know obviously as we all go through life, people get older, things happen, and so forth, and viewing it as all connected to one person or to certain causes or attributing that may not be logical. I'm just curious, because there does seem to be this aspect to the story where you have this negative influence sort of following people who are connected to Crowley.
Yeah, that I don't think I buy into, to be honest. I think there's a certain myth of that, and I think it's a myth that's been perpetuated by his past biographers, because it makes for a really good story. And it's obviously, you know, it's a good story that people, have stuck with people, because it's become part of the Crowley mythology. But I really don't think that's true. I mean, you know, yeah, okay, there's this, you know, there's the Kanchenjunga incident where two climbers died, although mountain climbing is a very dangerous exercise. I mean, I think that, you know, I forget which climber it is, but there's, you know, one of the people that was on that climb with Crowley had a brother that died, you know, in a mountaineering accident, that, you know, and it did dissuade him from climbing. You know, it's a dangerous sport. And, you know, in fact, you know, that tragedy happened, from them acting against Crowley's advice. But otherwise, you know, you've got, you know, you have children of Crowley's that have died from childhood illnesses, you know, and, you know, the infant mortality rate at the age, you know, is much higher than it is today. I don't know. I would have a hard time thinking of a lot of people who died, you know, Raoul Loveday drank some tainted water, you know, and died from that. But it's, you know, I don't get the sense that everyone around Crowley came to a bad end or went insane or anything like that. And in fact, I would say that, you know, I think one of the most important things in the book is, you know, I was trying to trace Connie Yeager, who was, you know, one of his scarlet women who everyone says, you know, he drove to suicide. And I was actually able to find what appears to be her immigration record coming into the United States. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that particular story, you know, this kind of followed the famous, you know, Boca de Inferno thing where Crowley feigned his suicide and turned up later. And it seems to me that, you know, because she was the one that you wrote the suicide note to. And it seems to me that she basically pulled the same stunt on him. She sent him a suicide note and left the country, you know, and I think that's one where it was a joke that he missed and that every Crowley biographer before me missed. Hmm.
Yeah, and I don't mean
you're trying to come in and say something.
Yeah, I don't mean to suggest that you presented the material that way. I think you're right. You did did exactly the opposite. I think my interpretation of it is probably colored by a lot of those other books, as you'd mentioned. But I do, for some reason, have that perception, which I don't really quite get.
I mean, to give you an example, I mean, when I want to talk about Freud, one of the things I like to do, particularly when this question comes up, and this thing, I think back to this one talk where I asked someone, hey, have you ever known anyone in your lifetime who has attempted to commit suicide? And almost everyone raised their hands. They said, you know anyone who has died, you know, close to you, almost everyone raises their hands. I say, was it your fault? You know, no one's hand stays up, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, so, yeah, you look at, you know, 77 years of someone's life, you know, can you blame them for everything that happens to every single person? You know, I mean, there's going to be tragedies in anyone's lifetime over 77 years. And ultimately, you know, people are responsible for their own behavior.
Really, the thing I'm trying to draw out of this whole aspect of the questions is, in the mountaineering incident, again, people were responsible for their own actions, and they were even warned ahead of time. And in many of these other situations, it probably is painted in ways by observers that are not realistic.
Yeah, and you know, if you think about it, really, I mean, I think it's this sort of bias to kind of remember the more colorful stories, the more tragic stories are the ones we remember the most.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Crowley knew hundreds of people in his lifetime. And most of them had just fine lives, you know, with or without him, you know. It's, you know, I just think we it's human nature to try and remember those really outstandingly grim sorts of tales. They're more compelling to us.
Not to prolong this, but I know for my own self, the people I know personally who've passed away sooner than expected, it's always such a huge impact on me personally and everybody around who knew them that it really does affect everyone so much.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, that was certainly the case with Crowley. I mean, when you know, his children died, you know, he was devastated. You know,
right.
Well, while they died, he was, you know, devastated. You know, these were tragedies for him just as much as they were for the other people in his life.
Sure. So Crowley began his magical career officially, I guess, in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. And I'm so fascinated by the whole story of the way he traveled to Paris for initiation with Mathers, and then it wasn't recognized by the London Temple, and there was this extreme schism that seemed to happen. If you could just talk a little bit about that and some of your impressions in researching it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this is one of those places where Crowley's myth plays larger than it was in reality. You know, the myth seems to be that, you know, Crowley joined the Golden Dawn, and he shot through the ranks, and, you know, he eventually blew the Golden Dawn up, and it just, you know, came to an end because of him. And none of that is true. I mean, he passed through the grades basically about one a month, and that was not unusual for Golden Dawn nor for other Masonic groups. I mean, you look at when people go from, you know, entry to apprentice to fellow craft to master mason. And in a lot of cases, those happen like a month apart. It's like boom, 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 and people go through those degrees. And the Golden Dawn kind of coming out of tradition, you see a lot of those people move through those degrees, you know, one every couple of months. So the fact that Crowley kind of moved at the pace that he did is not really that remarkable. It wasn't really Crowley who blew up the Golden Dawn. It was really Mathers who did it, who was, you know, one of the three founders of the Golden Dawn. Perhaps I should say Mathers. That's at least how Peter Cushing pronounces it.
Now, would you say you could make an argument that Mathers blew it up but kind of used Crowley as his scapegoat?
I think it was blowing up long before Crowley went to London, you know, as his, you know, factotum. You know, it started when, you know, Mathers claimed that, you know, Westcott had forged, you know, the Anna Springle letters, and that, you know, the Golden Dawn was all built on a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And then he insisted that everyone kind of sign a, you know, oath of allegiance to him as the supreme leader of the Golden Dawn when he had basically left London, was living in Paris, and was trying to, you know, exert the autocratic control of the Golden Dawn, you know, and then they were just like, you know, screw you. Hey, you know, that the whole time, this whole, you know, structure is built on a foundation of sand. If what you're telling us is true, that these documents were all a lie, we've been initiating people under the fraudulent, you know, grounds. And, you know, no, you're not the boss of us. and it was those sorts of things that happened, you know, and, you know, him, you know, expelling Annie Horniman and all these sorts of things. So, it was, you know, it was disintegrating Ryan's ears before Mathers advanced Crowley to Adeptus Minor and sent him to try to take care of things in London. That was the end game that was happening anyway. And then, you know, there's also the incident with the Horos couple, you know, who had, you know, kind of won Mathers' confidence, stole a bunch of Golden Dawn documents, and then started running some weird initiatory society to take advantage of young ladies, and that wound up in the newspaper, and, you know, that was pretty much game over for a while there, so... Crowley was basically there doing Mathers' work, but it, you know, the Golden Dawn was, you know, in a very bad way, you know, and stayed in a bad way with or without Crowley.
So can you talk a little bit about how Crowley decided that he was going to leave the Golden Dawn and go in his own direction?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what ended up happening was that he ultimately became disillusioned with the Golden Dawn. You know, it kind of, you know, blew up around him. But I think it's an exaggeration to say the whole thing blew up, because it really didn't cease functioning. I mean, there were other temples. You know, I think they did kind of go dark for a while after the Horos incident, but there were other temples of the Golden Dawn that, you know, continued to operate.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing, you know, how he was treated, how, you know, Mathers was regarded, and, you know, kind of having no place, you know, to go for his, you know, magical, you know, fix, you know, he kind of walked away. And part of this was his going to Mexico to climb mountains with, you know, Oscar Eckenstein. And, you know, part of this wound up, you know, being involved in, you know, Mathers not recognizing, or, you know, the Book of the Law as being a, you know, inspired text. But I think, you know, Crowley more and more just, you know, was growing distant to, you know, Mathers, who was once his friend. But, you know, just the whole thing kind of, you know, came apart for him as well when the Golden Dawn ended. You know, Mathers had moved to Paris. You know, his roommate and teacher, Alan Bennett, had, you know, moved to India to become a Buddhist monk. And, you know, there wasn't a whole lot left for him in the Golden Dawn at that point.
Mm-hmm. So it seems logical to talk a little bit about the Book of the Law, its reception, and the way that changed the direction of Crowley's life, I'd venture to say.
Oh, sure.
There have been many people who've written about the incident, including Crowley himself and his commentary on it. You address this in your book in a really straightforward manner, given that the situation obviously is not that straightforward in itself, but your impressions of what occurred, we all know the background. I think Crowley went to Cairo on his honeymoon with Rose, and they spent some time in the Great Pyramid. He did some invocations, and over the course of their stay in Cairo, some things happened. I guess am I correct in sort of setting the stage there?
Correct.
And then I'll let you take the story from there.
Well, as the story goes, and again, a lot of this, most of all of this actually relies on Crowley's account. So there were really only two people who were present for this, was Crowley and Rose. And Rose certainly didn't write about it. So all we have is Crowley's various accounts, and they're, you know, pretty consistent about what happened. And as he talks about it, you know, they spent a night on their honeymoon in the king's chamber in the Great Pyramid, and Crowley does some invocations there. He was kind of showing off for Rose for some of the magic stuff he did. And after that, it seems that Rose starts acting a little peculiar. And she's suggesting to Crowley that the gods want to have a word with him, that they have a message for him, and so on. And, you know, Crowley at first doesn't really pay a whole lot of attention to this, but finally decides that, you know, this has persisted long enough, and maybe he'll test this. And this is whole, you know, Crowley's whole scientific illuminism. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, if supposedly there's something trying to get a hold of me and using Rose as a vehicle, then you should be able to answer some basic questions. And he started asking her questions, things that Rose really would have had no way of knowing, because she didn't really study, you know, Egyptian mythology or religion or any of this stuff. And he asked a series of questions, you know, what's your favorite color, who are your friends, who are your enemies, you know, what day of the week, you know, and so on. And every question that he asked, she was able to answer. And that led him to mostly believe that this was genuine, that the odds against her answering all these questions correctly by chance alone was, you know, infinitesimal. So as a final test, he takes her to a museum, says, fine, if Horus wants to talk to me, show me a picture of Horus. She kind of marches past several other pictures of Horus and points to this funerary stele in the museum, and not only is it a picture of Horus, but it has, you know, museum catalog number 666 on it. And that kind of is the censure for Crowley. He says, okay, you know, not only is it Horus, but it's Horus with this numerical reference that was very significant for him, because he was identifying with, you know, the beast of Revelation already at this point. So that synchronicity was just too much. And so he said, okay, what do I got to do? And he was told to do a ritual, and he was all, you know, at the equinox, and also told on April 8th, 9th, and 10th at noon to go, you know, into his room with paper and pencil and write down what he heard. And he heard a voice, and, you know, he wrote down what the voice told him. And those were the three chapters of the Book of the Law, which was his revelation, or his mystical, you know, the cornerstone of his mystical philosophy.
Obviously, you consider the Book of the Law to be a holy book. I'm curious about the New Aeon English Kabbalah and what people have, I think, argued is kind of like a mathematical proof of the intelligence that delivered the text. And I don't know if I'm reaching here with this question or going a place I shouldn't, but I'm curious about your opinion on this validation of mystical texts based on complex mathematical algorithms and whatnot.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll start by saying that as a scientist, you know, by profession, that I am a big adherent of the principle of Occam's razor, and that, you know, a proof that is too complicated, you know, is something that I'm going to be suspicious about. You know, I think that truth needs to, you know, unfold in a very simple and beautiful sort of way. And you kind of go, okay. And, you know, when you get to things like, you know, English gematria, that's one place where my skepticism quotient is really, really high, because, you know, English really is a bastard language. I mean, we have, you know, words drawn from all kinds of different cultures, and, you know, some of those cultures had, you know, isocephic number letter systems. Some of them don't. English does not have a numerical system inherent in its alphabet, and to me it's a real stretch to kind of say there is something to, you know, numerically to the English language. I just don't buy it. You know, one could go the one step and say, well, it's possible that the person who dictated the Book of the Law chose particular English words, and the words that appear in the Book of the Law have specific numerical meaning, but words that don't appear in the Book of the Law may or may not, you know, is only slightly more convincing to me, but not a whole lot. But I don't know that that's necessary, you know. You know, there's a surface meaning to the Book of the Law. There's the idea, right, of the true will and finding and doing that will. Does that have compelling force to you? Does that make sense? You know, and in terms of having some sort of proof, I mean, Crowley felt that there were proofs of the you know, that the author of the, there were proofs that the author of the Book of the Law knew things that Crowley did not. Therefore, the source of the book came from something other than Crowley or someplace other than Crowley's own consciousness. And, you know, those two proofs for Crowley were basically when Charles Stanislaw Jones or Frederick Hodd wrote his Liber 31, you know, the finding that the words for God, El, and the words for not, Lo, in Hebrew, both had a value of 31. And this could be used to unlock and decipher and understand a lot of this wordplay that exists in the Book of the Law. Something that Crowley completely missed. He thought, hey, it took someone else to even find this. And that for him was one of the proofs. And another one of the proofs happened when he got a letter from a reader of the international newspaper he was the editor of in America. You know, Crowley was trying to figure out how to transliterate therion, you know, which is the Greek word for wild beast. He wanted to figure out how to send it was his, you know, magus motto. And Crowley wanted to figure out how to transliterate that into Hebrew, so they also added up to 666. And this guy came up with a solution, and he signed himself Samuel Iwas Jacobs. And Crowley looked at this word, and it kind of struck him. He always thought that Iwas, you know, the person who, you know, dictated the Book of the Law to him, he just thought it was kind of like a made-up word or an artificial word, you know, not a human tongue, but something like, you know, Amalantra or Abulbiz, you know, a word that comes from someplace else. And so to find that someone actually had the name Iwas surprised him, and so he wrote this guy and asked him, well, what, where does your name come from and how do you spell it? And the guy sent back the spelling, and it happened to add up to 93. And again, that kind of blew Crowley's mind, because again, this name that he, you know, had always assumed was not real, not only was it a real name, but it was a numerically significant name in his magical system. So those are like the two things in his life. There are, you know, probably others along the way that I'm not thinking of right now, but those are like the two biggies in his mind that said this proof that the, you know, Book of the Law came from a higher intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of Thelema, especially in terms of religion, for lack of a better word?
I think there's a lot of interesting things about Thelema compared to other religions. Mm-hmm. One is that it's the only religion that I can think of that whose central inspired holy book still exists and survives in its original copy. I think another thing that's very interesting about this is that Thelema as a religion is also one of the few where our prophet is very, very human. You know, there isn't this attempt to kind of, you know, make him into this divine, perfect being, you know, that people want to do with their religious prophets. I mean, he is a guy who, you know, had relationship troubles, he had divorces, he had, you know, a drug addiction, and, you know, he you know, he screwed up and he did good things. He was very human. I'm kind of reminded of something that Lon Duquette often says, is that the idea of magic is to make yourself divine, but becoming divine doesn't mean that you don't become... Becoming divine doesn't mean you become less human. It means that you become superhuman. You become this extra human, you know, in this process of doing magic. And I think that's a really neat thing about Flame Thing. And it's crafted as someone that anyone can relate to. There's other things I think are interesting about this is the idea that, you know, there's a relative lack of law. You know, there's, you know, these Ten Commandments or these 613, you know, rules in the Talmud and things like that. It's very simple. You know, you find your will and you act in accordance with it. And, you know, try not to interfere with other people's freedom to do that exact same thing. You know, and that's, you know, it's a very simple sort of system. It doesn't require a whole lot of, you know, lawmaking. You know, it's that's what the book says. You know, you have to go through the whole of the law. That's the law. Do it for will.
Mm-hmm.
End of discussion.
One of the things I think is so fascinating, this whole concept of degrees of esotericism, where you have Thelema, the Book of the Law, where you have the law is for all, as they say, and then you have things like rituals, which are like kind of symbolisms there presented, but it may be kind of veiled in meaning. And then you have other things like words or signs or images that may be fully hidden and only revealed to certain people at certain times and things like that. But it seems Thelema, as you said, it's kind of out there. It's very accessible. And I guess this is a reflection, too, of, and you write this, I think, in the book of Crowley's, what he considered his grade of attainment at that point of 9 = 2 of Magus, where he was actually promulgating a new religion. Is that right?
Yes.
Curious if you had any thoughts in terms of how Crowley's work is or isn't in some ways an evolution of Rosicrucianism as a tradition.
Well, I mean, to the extent that the Golden Dawn actually considered itself to be a Rosicrucian society, you know, when Crowley started publishing the Golden Dawn Rituals, you know, that was actually how Mavers presented himself to the courts and to the press, was that he was the head of the Rosicrucians. And the Golden Dawn was very much a outgrowth of the Societas Rosicruciana anyway. I mean, they used the exact same grade system, degree system. So, kind of taking a step from that, was that Crowley very much built his magic on the foundation that was the Golden Dawn. I mean, I think that there's a tendency to want to shortchange the Golden Dawn and not give it the credit that it's due. You know, Crowley kind of poo-poos the Golden Dawn and says, oh, all they gave me, the only secret they gave me was the Hebrew alphabet, you know, and you could learn that anywhere. You know, the Golden Dawn really was a very potent and very interesting synthesis of all kinds of different systems that had not been quite put together that way before. I mean, taking the Tree of Life and the Tarot and astrology and the grimoires and John Dee's magical system and finding that we're actually, you can kind of put it together in a way that really works and makes sense is actually pretty damn amazing if you sit back and you think about it. And everything that Crowley does is built on that foundation. I think it does a great disservice to the work of the Golden Dawn founders to kind of say, well, it's nothing but the Hebrew alphabet. I mean, you know, Crowley built on that. If you don't understand the Golden Dawn, you're not going to understand Crowley. And that being said, though, Crowley certainly tried to move beyond that and add to it. You know, I mean, I often think of Crowley's AA as kind of being like the Golden Dawn on steroids. You know, he brought in a lot of additional stuff that wasn't part of the Golden Dawn system and created his societies. And so, you know, he incorporated, you know, Eastern mysticism into it and, you know, a lot of other curriculum. I mean, the idea that he wanted his students to study, you know, philosophers and scientists as well as occultists, you know, but kind of a liberal arts, you know, sort of background is pretty new in and of itself, you know, for a mystical society.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I do think that what he's doing is a continuation of that kind of tradition. At least if you're talking about his AA, it really is just kind of carrying on a similar story. Yeah, again, AA uses the same golden, the same grade structure as a Golden Dawn. They may have defined, some of the requirements for those grades, but, it's still using the same system that the Golden Dawn borrowed from, Professor Cruciano, who borrowed it from the Golden Rosenkreutzers, and so on. So it's, it is really very much a continuation and a building upon, that whole school.
Mm-hmm. Where would you place Crowley in the context of world religious figures?
Well, Crowley, put himself, right up there with, Muhammad and Buddha and Krishna and mm-hmm. all the other dinosaurs that are in the Book of Wise. Whether Crowley winds up, historically being in that same category or not, is going to be up to history. I think, Crowley certainly has introduced a very individualistic style of religious philosophy that is very new. It is very much of this day and age. Is everyone someday going to be a Thelemite the way, so many people today are Christians? And I don't know. I mean, it seems that, in some ways it's almost like, it really, as the Book of the Law says, all the laws for all. It also says, let my servants be few in secret. There may be a more pop culture manifestation of these ideas. And just to give you an example, I often think of, I've heard the interviews with Lady Gaga. Okay, this may sound silly, but, she kind of talks about how she had this nickname as a kid, and then she used to get up every day in the in the morning, look in the mirror, and imagine, this pop icon she wanted to be. And she gave it this name, Whitey Gaga. It's just like, it wasn't, you could call it positive affirmation, but for me, it was like, it almost became like a magical motto for her. And this thing that she aspired to, and I think that's magic. She's using different language, but it's not all that different from what, people who are doing magic talk about, coming up with a motto and, of what they aspire to. But whether, Flamer will, catch on as a world religion, or it will be something that in some other, expression, will be more popular. I don't know. I don't know that Flamer is necessarily the only expression of the Aeon of Horus that's going to be out there, just as, the Book of Revelation or the Gospel of John or whatever was the only expression of Aeon of Horus. I mean, there have been many religious texts that have occurred in the Aeon of Horus, so it's possible that there may be other sorts of things that happen in the Aeon of, Horus that, comes after Osiris. So, I guess we'll have to see.
You bring up an interesting point about magical mottos. And you name the book Perdurabo after Crowley's neophyte motto, I believe. And if you could just talk a little bit about Perdurabo, the significance of it, and why you chose that motto as the name of the book.
Well, the reason I stuck with that is that throughout Crowley's diaries to the end of his life, he celebrated and observed his magical birthday, the day that he was first initiated with Golden Dawn. So again, Crowley may poo-poo the Golden Dawn publicly and say, they were kind of cheesy, but that was, a important day for him, a day that he observed the rest of his life. And, it seemed to me that when I went to write this book, rather than starting with his mundane birthday, I wanted to start with his magical birthday, because it was very important to him. And, the motto that he chose as a neophyte in the Golden Dawn was Perdurabo, which is, I shall endure, I will endure to the end. It's been translated various different ways. And, it's a biblical quote or a biblical reference, I think the meaning, for Crowley is actually very extra biblical. It's, you know, he is someone who did find himself kind of, you know, maybe reluctantly at first, but he found himself as the great promulgator of a philosophical and religious creed. And you know, once he took up that responsibility, he never shirked it. He is a person who walked the talk and never backed down a day in his life. I mean, to the very end. he endured. I mean, that was, you know, he never faltered from that mission. And I think that's really the most notable thing about Crowley. You can say what you want about him in terms of his particular beliefs, his ability or inability to deal with business, or his inability or ability to deal with people, or whatever. You like his poetry or not. At the end of the day, he was a person who stuck by his beliefs. You know, he did not sell them out. He did not change them to make them, you know, they were convenient for him. It was, you know, he lived and breathed it, you know, to the day he died.
And not that anything further is even required, but because you are in this position of being the foremost biographer of Crowley, I would just like to hear your comment, because there's still a lot of Crowley detractors and attackers and haters out there, and there's a lot of myths and misinformation and disinformation spread about Crowley, and it continues now. And as someone who's really done a tremendous amount of work to, I think, set the story straight, I'm just curious if you have any further comment about that.
It seems to me that a lot of the stories that are out there of the haters are people who really don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that people have actually read a reliable or accurate account. There's so much information out there about Crowley. And just to give you an example, you know, the number of websites out there that claim that, you know, Barbara Bush is Crowley's granddaughter or whatever, when this is like an April Fool's joke,
mm-hmm.
you know, from a number of years ago, and people don't even have, you know, the perspicacity to see through that. And they see it on the internet, they assume it's true, and they repeat it. And I think there's a lot of that going on, you know, whether it's, you know, people are just hearing what they've read on some website somewhere, or whether it's someone who's heard their magical teacher or their high priest or high priestess or whomever say, oh, Crowley once did this, I don't like him. I think that's a source of a lot of prejudice. And all I could say, anyone who might have any curiosity or doubt about Crowley, is just, you know, get the facts. You know, I mean, you read my book, or if you don't want to read my book, and there's a couple other really good ones out there that have come out in the past 10 years, read something, you know, recent that's you know, well reviewed and respected, and, you know, draw your own opinion. If at the end of the day you don't like him, well, that's, you know, that's really your business. And that's kind of why I try not to interject my business, you know, my opinion into the book.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to tell the story. And, you know, whatever opinion you walk away with is, you know, that's what I want the reader to do. I want the reader to form their own opinion. But, you know, I just want people to have an informed opinion, I guess.
I'm curious if you had any insights or revelations beyond what you've already spoken about in terms of Crowley or Thelema or magic in general while you were writing the book.
You know, one thing that, actually I think two things that kind of occurred to me. One is that, you know, as I read Crowley's letters and diaries, particularly his diaries, he writes them very self-consciously. It's kind of like he expects that his diaries are going to be read by future generations. And it's not that he censors himself, you know. I mean, he records every act of sex magic or whatever. He records details of his fights and bullets with people. I mean, it's all in there, but at the same time, it's like there's this consciousness there. And, you know, I've often looked at Crowley as somebody who basically set himself up as an example for other would-be magicians, basically saying, hey, look, I'm laying my whole spiritual path out, you know, warts and all. And the idea is this, these are the steps I took. You can read his diaries in the Temple of Solomon the King about his concentration exercises and how many breaks he had during those exercises and so on. You can see, how he did his, Born with One invocation. You can see how he received the Book of the Law and all these things. And the idea there is, I am an example of someone on the magical path. If you follow the magical path and take the steps I took, you can expect something kind of similar. You're not going to be the same thing, but, he's basically laid out, very clearly a magical path that one can follow. And I think that's very useful. I think at some point, you got to not just copy Crowley or try to be Crowley, because that's, ultimately self-defeating. Again, it's do up to what you got to find who you are and be true to that and not try to be Crowley. But the fact that he, made an example of a spiritual path, I think is extremely valuable for anyone who is taking steps onto that path themselves. The other thing that I see that's very valuable in Crowley is that when I look at things like his 777 tables of correspondences or his Sefer Oath, his dictionary of Kabbalistic correspondences and things like that, I don't see those as being, the last word in anything. 777 is something that, you look at those tables, there's a lot of other things you could be tabulating in those tables. Crowley, for me, is kind of pointing the way to go forward. And it's not like 777 is the last word in Kabbalistic correspondences. It's kind of like he just raised the bar. But there's all kinds of work that could be done. I mean, my own personal notes, I've got, probably another 300 columns that aren't in 777 that I've compiled myself. I've got, two ring binders full of, the Matria calculations I've done on other words in Greek and Hebrew and Coptic and Enochian and these other things that are part of my, personal practice. And, Crowley, the stuff that he talks about, that's on the reading lists and the stuff that he's reading and practicing and drawing from, is the literature that was, a lot of this literature at least, was very, very current. I mean, he was always, keeping an eye on what was cutting edge and what was new and picking that up and incorporating that into what he did. And there is so much that has come out since, Crowley has done this. I mean, we've had, all the Nag Hammadi texts, were discovered in 1945 and, they've been continuously translated. There's magical texts in the Cairo Geniza that have been uncovered. There's great scholarship that's being done in Kabbalah and in Tantra and things like this. And you pretty much pick any spiritual mystical path. There's just a fantastic amount of new information that a magician today can pick up and work with in the same way that Crowley did it, or any of his old non-compatriots, Westcott, Mavers, all of those people, they were translating new books, and as they were translating them, kind of incorporating them into the Golden Dawn rituals. I mean, they were not just reading, but they were trying to find the ways of incorporating it into their spiritual practice. And those, I think, are all important lessons for anyone who is on this path. I mean, you can't just be looking backward at what did Crowley do, but kind of follow his lead. And
in terms of what's going on in the current world of esoteric practice, do you feel that there is enough moving forward in a coherent manner, or is there too much reliance on tradition, or is it a mix? I know this is a kind of a hot topic for people to debate right now, but whether we have a living tradition or if it's more of a museum piece that we like to take out and play with.
Well, I would say that from my own experience with Enochio, I think we've actually got both going on. I mean, I think the fact that Ordo Templiori at this performs and preserves the initiation rituals as Crowley wrote them, intended them to be done, is not necessarily a bad thing. It's a museum piece or whatever. It's, there is a tradition within initiatory societies, and this is true in Freemasonry as well, that, know, you follow the rituals that have been kind of passed down to you. You're custodians of a tradition. And that's what's happening with OTO and its rituals as well. But at the same time, you know, OTO and its various bodies around the world are not just doing those rituals. I mean, they are, you know, offering classes and original rituals and things like that, you know, every single month at their local bodies. And, you know, those individuals are, you know, reading and studying and practicing, and they're, you know, presenting a mix of things. And they're presenting, you know, Crowley's texts and stuff about Salima. They're also writing brand new rituals or bringing in the results of what they've studied. And so I think there very much is a living, breathing, and growing component of people's magical practice. And it's exciting to see. You know, there was, just a couple of months ago, there was a symposium in London hosted by Anna Flodge that had, you know, a number of speakers talking about, you know, their magical work and research. And again, a very interesting mix of people were talking about whether, you know, some of it was kind of historic. I talked about, you know, some of the OTO's origins. We had people who were also talking about, you know, new research, new practice. In a similar sort of way, you have, you know, a lot of these traditions kind of publishing these day and age. You know, if you've got, you know, Zoanon and Freehand Press kind of publishing the works of, you know, that whole of Chumbly and that Sabbatic tradition there. You've got, oh, I'm blanking. Hang on a sec. And over in the UK, you've got Scarlet Imprint. They're kind of doing the same thing. They're very, very, very big into you know, promoting the work of actual practicing magicians. You know, and it's not just the armchair folks. I think this is actually a very exciting time. There's actually a lot of really good stuff out there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there in general, but, you know, if you go looking for it, there's actually good stuff to be found.
Oh, I agree completely. I would big props to Scarlet Imprint. I also want to mention Salamander and Sons as well. I think there's a lot of great stuff that they're putting out too.
Yeah, and there are a lot of great presses. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Folger. You know, they've done a great job with like the sort of you know, spare stuff they've been bringing out, and
Ouroboros Press in Seattle.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now we're on the dangerous list. Like, oh, who have we forgotten?
Yeah. Any we've forgotten, apologies. But yeah, there's so many great books coming out. It's really amazing. And one question I think it's important to get your response to here is really in the interest of people listening, because I think obviously they're interested in the subject of magic and esotericism, religion, spirituality, mysticism, etc. What, in your opinion, sets Crowley, Thelema, the OTO, or the AA, or these organizations apart? Why would someone who's interested in the Western tradition want to investigate Crowley and the OTO or the AA if they haven't already? Personally, I think there's a huge attraction and draw to his work. You're probably a much more eloquent authority on this subject, so I'd rather have you answer the question.
Okay. Well, you know, one thing I find is that, you know, when it comes to spirituality, there isn't necessarily a one-size-fits-all sort of thing. And while, again, Thelema may be for all, you know, OTO and PAA may or may not be for everybody. And one of the beautiful things about, you know, the OTO is that, you know, bodies of OTO do have a lot of open events that people can go to. And OTO also has an introductory sort of degree called, you know, the Minerval. And in the Minerval degree, you know, allows you to go through an initiation that is very powerful and very moving, but at the same time, you are not committing to full membership in the organization. You're considered to be, you know, a guest. And that kind of allows you to kind of like, kind of put your foot in the door, kind of look around and, you know, participate and see if this is the sort of thing that you might like. And if not, you know, no foul, no harm. You can walk away or you can proceed. You can stay a Minerval the rest of your life. You know, it's, you know, there are many options open to you at that point. And I think that's one of the neat things about it. You don't have to say, yes, I want to join, but you get this chance to kind of test drive, if you will. But I think part of the appeal of it is twofold. You know, Crowley's system is very syncretic. It borrows from a lot of different traditions, and it continues to borrow from traditions, you know, from those who practice this going beyond Crowley. You know, one of the things I tend to see a lot is, you know, of people have a lot of interest in Santeria and Paolo and things like that and want to kind of figure out of ways of working that into their practice. But they're also Thelemites. And just in the sense that Crowley was able to incorporate, you know, aspects of Kabbalah and Egyptian magic and Greek, you know, theurgy and things like that and Eastern mysticism. You know, this is the system that you can, that can kind of absorb and incorporate elements from other spiritual traditions, if you want. And, in that sense, you know, it's not limiting your options. But if anything, it's really opening your options. I think the idea is, you know, Crowley, it really very much espouses the scientific illuminism. It's, you know, find, you know, your work magic, test it. Find something that works. If something doesn't work, throw it away, try something else. And you kind of continue in that quest until you find the magical rituals and the magical work that gets results for you. And that may not be the same thing that worked for him or for, you know, your buddy next door or whatever, but, you know, you are using this very methodical system to find out what works for you. And then, you know, you can pick up that ball and run with it. So in the sense that, you know, the system, you know, basically leaves the door wide open for you to find a practice that's right for you, and also gives you some tools to really evaluate your success in a really very methodical, one could almost say scientific sort of way. You know, are two things I think are very appealing about the system of Philemon.
Yeah,
or magic, as Crowley would call it, magic with a K.
Right. This is kind of a stretch, but seeing as how I have you on the phone right now, I'm going to ask it anyway because I think it's relevant, and I know it's hypothetical, but what do you think Crowley's opinion might be of the current political and social unrest that we see going on in the world today?
One thing I think that Crowley would certainly see with a lot of the sort of thing like the Arab Spring is very much a living example of the principles that he espouses in Liber Oz. The idea that there are certain inalienable rights that all human beings have, and that if there is some sort of authority or government or other structure that seeks to circumvent those rights, then people have the right to rise up and assert those rights, and if necessary, kill those who are thwarting those rights. And I think that's very much what you have been seeing, you know, throughout the Arab world, and that kind of social unrest. I mean, it's just, you know, there are countries where very basic human rights are not allowed, and all of a sudden, en masse, then you have these countries are all kind of saying, no more, I don't want this anymore. And in many ways, I would see that as being, you know, examples of the birth pains that we would, you know, we would expect to see from the realization of that philosophy that's, you know, expressed in Liber Oz. I think a lot of people, you know, want to look at Liber Oz as kind of like a, you know, I'm going to do whatever I want, and, you know, then if you get in my way, I'm going to kill you. But I think the flip side of Liber Oz is that, well, if you get in my way, I'm going to kill you too. you know, so I think there needs to be some moderation there. But I think the important thing is people got to be free to be able to do, you know, to exercise and experience their fundamental rights.
To me personally, I think that's one of the most inspiring aspects of Thelema as a philosophy or a religion or whatever you want to call it, is this emphasis on freedom or liberty. And I find it interesting too, the way this, it's not necessarily a militant like a literal militancy, but a sort of like an inspired call to arms in a metaphorical or philosophical sense in the Book of the Law, particularly in the third chapter. Maybe that's kind of what it invokes in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, there certainly is a call to arms, and Crowley very much uses that language. I mean, he really felt that a lot at the time he was writing a lot of his works and those rituals and working on his game plan for OTL and things like that, that he was very much aware that this was a very, very scary time in history. You know, he talks about how, you know, the OTL has just been getting started, you know, in the early 1910s, and then there's this world war. And it's a scale of like unlike anything that had ever been seen before. And it's like he really was the sense that there was danger that, you know, all this gnosis or whatever, you know, these secrets that had been recovered, you know, could literally be obliterated by this global conflict. And I think a lot of that call to arms. It's like we need to defend these freedoms. We need to preserve this knowledge, because that's a very big part of Crowley's writings from that period. And not to get all political either. I mean, I kind of think about, you know, Crowley's Constitution for the OTRs or his, you know, Intimation, where he kind of talks, you know, he kind of goes on this like anti-democratic tirade, you know, where he kind of says, oh, you know, the democracy never elects, you know, the great man or the man of vision, but, you know, offends kind of the mediocre man, the man who offends the most people the least. And, you know, I kind of look at, you know, what's happening in politics, particularly now with, you know, these primaries trying to, you know, select, you know, the Republican, you know, candidate. And I feel like that's never been more true. Where's the great people?
I know. It seems like a process really designed to draw out mediocrity. And I think we're seeing the results of that, too.
Yeah.
Crowley's really such a dynamic man, and he's multifaceted, talented in so many ways. And I think it's obvious why you find him a fascinating person, why so many others do. I mean, personally, to me, he is really the most interesting individual in the history of the Western esoteric tradition. And you've written, again, this is the authoritative biography on his life, Perdurabo, The Life of Aleister Crowley. And I'm just curious, before we let you go, if you could talk a little bit about the reception of the book, not just by people who are interested in Crowley, but also by the larger public who may not be interested in magic in general.
The reception has been really good. I mean, I've heard, you know, mostly good things about the book, which is gratifying, you know, and it's certainly something I never get tired of hearing, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, it was a long book, and it's, you know, to write, you know, it's a process, and, you know, there's, you know, as I suppose as a writer, you know, it's hard not to look back and you know, second guess and doubt yourself. So, you know, hearing the good things is always nice. But, you know, to see, you know, things like the Times Literary Supplement, you know, saying, you know, very complimentary things about the book, you know, is very gratifying. You know, it doesn't get much better than the Times Literary Supplement. But, you know, there have been all kinds of people, you know, who wanted to have spoken out about the book, you know, and, you know, I don't personally know, you know, many of those people, if not most of the people who have written words for the book, but to see those sorts of things is, you know, from people that I respect tremendously, saying that, you know, they like the book or they did a great job is, you know, mind-blowing. You know, I mean, I started this journey, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, and mostly because, you know, I I was just basically fed up reading, you know, the sorts of crap that people are writing as about Crowley and passing off his biography. You know, it's just this really kind of opinionated, you know, rhetoric. This, you know, they're just potboilers. And I kind of, you know, wrote this book as a reaction to that, saying, I don't know, I just want to tell the guy's story. I want to be accurate. I don't want to try to read my reader by the nose. I don't want to distort what really happened just to make a book. I want to tell the actual story. And, you know, to be here and feel that not only have I succeeded in that, but that other people, you know, are finding value in that work is very satisfying.
I can't speak for anyone else, but I've seen the reactions to the book, and I personally would highly recommend it. I think it really, like you said, it makes Crowley intensely human, and it gives a portrayal of the man that I have not encountered elsewhere. And I think we're all fortunate that you've invested so much time and energy in putting this book together. It's really amazing. So again, thank you, Richard Kaczynski. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you and to read the book. And I hope other people will too.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you also for the recommendation. And I hope people who listen to this will consider reading it if they haven't already.